pair of soft cotton athletic pants and a T-shirt, jacked up the air conditioning, plugged the thumb drive into his laptop, and opened Carter's files. Jack Parrish was a thin, coffin-pale man with close-set eyes who used too much gel in his dark hair, enough that you could see the tracks left by his comb. He wore suits that were too dark and too sharp, like he had picked them out of the pages of GQ. The photos in the file were all head and shoulders only, the type used for passports and security cards. He'd always faced the various cameras with the same hard glare. Parrish was 38. He'd graduated from Ohio State when he was 22 with a B.S. in economic geography, served 4 years as an Army intelligence officer, and joined the Central Intelligence Agency when he finished his active military service. He spent 4 years with the CIA, worked for a private company called Heracles Personnel for 3 more years, then took a job as a researcher for the Senate Intelligence Committee, and later became an aide to Terran Grant. He was still in the military reserve, currently with the rank of major. That would, Lucas thought, give him a broad range of contacts, both in the Pentagon and in the wider intelligence community. The file included a list of publications, some of which were marked as classified, although the level of classification wasn't specified. At the CIA, Parrish seemed to have specialized in aerial and satellite photo interpretation and had written a number of papers on the subject. He had also written 2 papers with obscure titles that seemed to be mathematical studies of where irregular fighters could be found. That all sounded like desk jobs to Lucas, but Parrish had a bronze star with a V device and a purple heart. Lucas didn't know what a V device meant, and when he looked it up, it turned out that a bronze star could be awarded for general meritorious service, even to a civilian. A news reporter had gotten one once. But a V device indicated valor and was a combat award. Lucas knew the Purple Heart meant that Parrish had been wounded, but there were no details on the wound. Other military awards included ribbons for service in both Afghanistan and Iraq. So Parrish had been shot at and apparently hit. Nothing in the files indicated that the Army had any doubts about him. He had been married and later divorced, and currently seemed to be not married. His ex-wife was named and had a security clearance, but the level of the clearance wasn't mentioned. Parrish got consistently high evaluations as a Senate researcher and later as an aide to Grant. A second file contained Parrish's divorce decree. The divorce had been in Maryland and had apparently been by mutual consent. His wife got the house, but no alimony. There was no testimony about abuse or anything else other than their agreement that the marriage was irretrievably broken. A third file contained a list of companies that would incur economic impacts, both bad and good, under Senate bills that Carter expected to receive bipartisan support. Heaviest impacts were on businesses and communities that supported now obsolete military bases that were facing closure. Smalls supported all of the closures except one on the West Coast. Carter noted that he wanted that base kept open as the possible site for an atomic power reactor, but since all of the California delegation, both Republicans and Democrats, opposed the idea of a reactor on the coast, Smalls' opposition to the closure was seen as idiosyncratic and garnered little support. There was no reason to kill Smalls for any of his Senate activity, as far as Lucas could see. A fourth, even shorter file contained nothing but a list of 4 names, with addresses and telephone numbers, and a note from Carter that said, "These people don't like Parrish and might talk to you. Call me when you're done with this." When he'd finished with the files, Lucas knew all kinds of things he hadn't known that morning, but nothing that pointed in any particular direction. If anything, Paris seemed like an accomplished bureaucrat, somebody who'd always been good at what he did. Lucas closed the laptop down and called Carter on the burner phone. She answered on the third ring, and he asked, "Can you talk?"
"Sure."
"I've read the files, and Parrish doesn't seem like a terrible guy, but you said he was a snake. Why is he a snake, and what's with the list of names?"
"He is a snake, and part of his snakiness is that he doesn't seem like an awful guy to most people. He's a sociopath, in my opinion, but a cautious one. He doesn't care who gets hurt as long as it's not him."
"A good match for Grant, then," Lucas said. "I think the same thing about her, although she might be darker than a simple sociopath. She could be a full-blown psycho."
"Whatever. I'm not sure how much definitions help," Carter said. "Anyway, that list of names, those are people who have reason to seriously dislike Parrish and who might be in a position to give you some information about him. He has made some enemies getting to where he is, and I listed them in the order that would reflect the intensity of their dislike. Joe Rose, the first guy, probably likes him the least, hates him, actually, and so on. That's something I keep track of."
"Okay, thank you."
"Lucas, you scared me this morning," she said. "The secret phones and all that. If you read those files, you can see that there's not much detail in them. You can remember everything you need to know about Parrish and his wife and his jobs. I'd appreciate it if you'd get rid of that thumb drive. If somebody got that drive from you, they might be able to figure out who copied the files and, from that, who got them. Me."
"I'll get rid of it," Lucas said. "I mean, really get rid of it. Everything but the names." He did just that when he got off the phone. He copied down the names, addresses, and phone numbers of Parrish's supposed enemies, smashed the thumb drive with the sliding shower door, and flushed the pieces down the toilet. That done, he went back to the desk, looked at the notepad with Joe Rose's phone number on it, and punched the number into his phone.
6. Joe Rose had a voice that sounded like gravel being shoveled from a truck. Too much whiskey, cigars, or both. Lucas only told him he was a U.S. Marshal, that he was investigating an auto accident only peripherally involving Mr. Rose. He didn't mention either Jack Parrish or Porter Smalls. Rose told Lucas he lived in Bethesda, Maryland, and that he'd be around all day.
"I work at home now."
Lucas retrieved his car from the valet, followed the GPS through tangled traffic to Bethesda, which was northwest of the district. The distance couldn't have been more than 10 miles, but took him almost 40 minutes to drive. Rose lived in what was probably an expensive house, half brick, half white clapboard, of a style that Lucas thought of as confused. It had a bunch of overlapping roofs, a truncated clapboard turret, 2 single-car garage doors that probably fed the same double-car garage, a cobblestone driveway, and a manicured front lawn. The front door gave onto a tiny covered porch, good only for keeping the rain off visitors while they waited for a ride. Several black cables led from a telephone pole near the street to the house. Power lines, maybe a hardwired phone, maybe cable television internet, but a couple of more as well, although Lucas didn't know what function they might serve. Lucas parked in the driveway, stepped out into a humid, nearly wet heat, and rang the doorbell. As he waited, he looked up and down the street. No people, no cars, nothing moving, not even a cat. A bedroom community. The door opened, and a man who was probably Joe Rose stood in the doorway and asked,
"Do you have some ID?"
"I do," Lucas said. He showed Rose his badge and ID card, and Rose stepped back and said,
"Come on in." I can't think of any reason that I would, but should I have a lawyer here?
Lucas shook his head. No. The investigation doesn't involve you in any way, except as a possible source of information. Rose was Lucas's height and build, but older, retirement age, gray-haired, large-nosed, with a pair of inexpensive computer glasses pushed up on his forehead. Close up, his voice sounded even harsher than it had on the phone. An injury of some kind. He hadn't gotten it singing. He was pale, like an office worker, and freckled. Wore tan slacks and a golf shirt. Loafers, but no socks. He said,
"Okay, I got the time. You know I don't have a regular job anymore."
"No, I didn't know that," Lucas said, as he followed him into the house and down a hallway. The hallway opened into what had probably been designed as a family room, but now was being used as a spacious office with three separate computer monitors on a library table.
"Yeah, I'm a contract researcher now. You know what's not on the internet now?"
"I thought everything was."
"Nope. There's tons of government stuff that isn't. Stuff that's still important, but that was recorded before 2000 or so," Rose said. "Internet people don't know how to do paper research, courthouse research, so I'm doing fairly well. I'm praying it keeps up because I can use the money."
"Cool. You invented your own job," Lucas said.
"Yep. So, what's up?"
Rose pointed Lucas at a leather club chair and took an identical chair facing Lucas across a fuzzy brown and tan rug. Not married, Lucas thought. Women generally didn't allow big fat leather chairs or brown fuzzy rugs in their family rooms. Lucas, "I'm told you don't much care for a man named Jack Parrish. I need to know more about Mr. Parrish, about his character." Rose responded with a grunt, then asked,
"What does that have to do with an auto accident?"
"I don't want to talk about that," Lucas said. He softened things with a smile. "I know it's horseshit, but I can't right now tie two things together with somebody I don't know."
"Got it," Rose said.
He sighed and said,
"Parrish is, I mean, calling him an asshole or a son of a bitch doesn't do the man justice. Even in Washington, he's something special. And believe me, we've got a glut of assholes around here."
Rose had worked for the CIA at the same time Parrish had, both as middle managers in parallel departments, as Rose put it.
"I can't tell you what we were doing, but it was technical.
I saw a file that said Parrish did something with photo interpretation."
"He did, but let's just leave it there. If you got that information by seeing a list of his so-called publications, he stole most of those things from his subordinates," Rose said. "Anyway, he was there for 5 or 6 years. I overlapped him on both ends in terms of employment. During that time, I watched him undermine anyone he thought might someday challenge him. Bad personnel reports, that kind of thing. He was an attention junkie and an ass-kisser. What I'm saying is, he stepped on a lot of good people and tried to crawl up the org chart over their bodies. Eventually, people began to catch on. It caught up with him, and he got out. Moved over to the Senate as a staff member."
"Leaving you where?"
"Where I was. I had an obscure job, important but not flashy. At least I thought it was important, and I was good at it. Then we had a situation come up, that I don't want to talk about yet. Parrish advocated one kind of response. We advocated another. My boss and I went over to SIC, the Senate Intelligence Committee, with some documents that suggested that Parrish was bullshitting them on behalf of a faction over at the Pentagon. He and the Pentagon got their way, and what happened later was a goddamn disaster. Too big even for an effective cover-up."
He looked up at the ceiling, both hands in the air, grinned at Lucas, but leaned forward and whispered,
"People died. People who shouldn't have. Lots of them."
"Lucas, who got blamed?" Rose tapped his chest.
"I did. Not for the disaster, but for the fact that some of it got out to the press. One of the senators brought the deputy director over for a closed-door meeting, and the next thing I knew, I was talking to our security people about leaks. Shit, I didn't even know a reporter. I said so, but they kept after me. This went on for a year, and I got what they called a lateral transfer to a non-sensitive position, pending resolution of the leaking case. I had 33 years in, and I said, fuck it, and retired. When I was going out the door, a pal of mine, higher up the line, took me aside and said that he believed the whole thing was a dirty trick engineered by Parrish, who'd been telling people that I'd been leaking and that me leaking might even have caused the problem. That I'd been leaking before the action. Somebody overheard me, and word had been passed to the Syrians. Damn lie, every bit of it. I found out later he'd gone to work for the senator who'd been asking the questions.
Taryn Grant, Lucas said. Rose nodded and asked,
"You want a Pepsi or a beer?"
After asking the question, he nodded vigorously, a pantomime nod. Lucas said, "Yeah, I could use a Pepsi. I haven't had anything to drink since I left the hotel."
"Come on, I'll get you one," Rose said.
In the kitchen, he opened the refrigerator, took out two Pepsis, handed one to Lucas, and said,
"Let's go out and sit by the pool. I got an umbrella out there."
Outside, he led the way past the pool to the end of the backyard.
"I'm probably overcooking things a little, but I worry about surveillance, especially since I know what can be done if they want to do it," he said. "I doubt anyone's actually watching me. If they are, they wouldn't be bugging us out here."
Lucas said, "Okay.
Anyway, what I don't understand is, why did Senator Grant jump into this with both feet? Stick a bullshit investigation on me and on my boss. She didn't have to do that. What would she get out of it?"
Lucas had an answer to that question, but he didn't say what he thought. That Grant was buying Parrish's loyalty. Instead, he said, "I need to know the dimension of this disaster. I won't talk about it to anyone, but I need to know. I will tell you that the matter I'm investigating is extremely serious, more so than you can probably imagine." Rose looked around the yard, took a hit on his Pepsi, and said,
"I don't even know if you're really a marshal. You could be spoofing me."
"You could look me up on the internet. There's a lot of stuff there, going back years."
"I'll do that," Rose said. "In the meantime, I'm not going to say anything more. We're talking about federal prison."
"I don't think so," Lucas said. "If all this works out the way I suspect it will, they'd be afraid to go after you."
"You don't know," Rose said. "I don't believe that they're afraid of anybody."
"You'd be wrong about that," Lucas said.
"Give me your email," Rose said. "Maybe I'll get back to you."
"Tell me one more thing. I'm sure it isn't classified, but it's something you'd know," Lucas said. "Parrish was an active-duty military officer, stayed in the reserve, and is now a major, and he's moving up to lieutenant colonel sometime soon. Would his service with the Army and the CIA, and now with the Senate, give him access to, you know, people with an ability to do violence?" Rose squinted at him, licked his lips.
"Who'd he get shot?"
"Nobody. But if he wanted to get somebody shot, would he have the connections? I'm not talking about a military shooting, a terrorist shooting, but a civilian shooting here in the U.S. Could he get a couple of names?" Another hit on the bottle and a quick nod.
"Oh, yeah. in about 5 minutes, and now I am done."
Rose refused to say anything more. Lucas left him standing by the pool and walked around the house and out to the street. The second, third, and fourth entries on Carter's list all lived in Virginia on the other side of the district. He'd get them later in the afternoon, he thought, and could stop at the hotel on the way. The first time Lucas had encountered Grant, she'd worked through two ex-military security men whom she'd paid to kill for her. And one of them she'd bound to herself with the pretense of loving him. Grant would do what was necessary to recruit people she thought she needed. Political favors, money, sex, whatever she thought it would take. If she needed Parrish's particular kind of expertise, she'd probably bought his loyalty by protecting him from criticism. Maybe even saved his job. There was also the prospect of the White House. Back at the hotel, Lucas washed his face and went to the laptop, clicked on his email, expecting a note from Weather, and maybe from his daughter Letty, who was in her third year at Stanford. There was nothing from Letty, but he did have a brief note from Weather with school news and another email from Rose, hiding behind the name Donald R. Ligney, with a subject line that identified him. "Looked you up on the internet." Scrolling down, Lucas found a Washington Post story about the bombing of a Syrian nerve gas warehouse that turned out to be a souk, or marketplace, instead, with a small school for girls at one end. The Syrians claimed that 94 people had been killed, most of them women or children, a claim verified by a religious charity and with photographs. The school had been wiped out. Under the story, there were 6 added words. "We told them. They didn't listen." Years before, Lucas had seen a Tom Clancy movie. He couldn't remember the name of it, but Harrison Ford was in it. He remembered one scene in particular in which a British SAS team had wiped out a terrorist training camp someplace in North Africa. The scene had stuck in Lucas's head because he'd spent his life working murders, murders which had often horrified him. In the Clancy movie, the SAS attack had been monitored by satellite, and a group of CIA suits had casually watched the attack and conducted a running commentary. "There's a kill," one had said while leisurely drinking a cup of coffee. The scene was chilling, as it was intended to be. There were people down there, dead, executed while they slept. They were terrorists, probably deserved what they got, but they were still people snuffed out in an instant. The Post story, combined with what Lucas had been told by Rose, reflected the same kind of bureaucratic attitude as the Clancy scene. People more interested in taking care of their operational lives, their political lives, than the fact that a whole lot of people died at their hands. Parrish and Grant hustling around to shift the blame. Forget about the women and children blown to bloody rags in a split second. Lucas got his car back and let the navigation system guide him across the Potomac to a neighborhood of neat brick homes and crooked elderly trees on a blacktopped lane in Arlington, Virginia. Another bedroom community, but at least 100 years older than Rose's place in Maryland. Of the 3 additional names on Carter's list, Lucas had gotten no answer with 2 of his phone calls, but the 3rd call had been picked up by a woman named Gladys Ingram. She was a partner in an Arlington law firm and said she could be home for an hour or so.
"If I'm going to talk to a marshal about anything, I'd rather it not be here," she said, referring to her office.
Lucas looked up the firm, found that it had 2 dozen partners and more than 80 associates, and did a lot of lobbying. Ingram's car, a silver Mercedes SL550, was parked in the driveway when Lucas arrived. The street was so narrow that he pulled in behind her car to keep from blocking it.
Like Rose, when she came to the door, Ingram asked to see Lucas's ID. Unlike Rose, after Lucas's original call, she'd gone straight to a computer and looked him up on the Internet. There were several hundred references to his time as a cop with two different Minnesota agencies, and there was a brief note in a Star Tribune gossip column that he'd moved to the U.S. Marshal's office. There were also a dozen photos taken over a 20-year span of Lucas at various crime scenes. Not content with that, she'd used a law office code to check his credit rating.
"Okay, if you're spoofing me, you've gone to a lot of trouble to do it," she said, still standing in the doorway. "I have to say, you're apparently the richest marshal I've ever met."
"I got lucky with a computer startup when I was between police agencies," Lucas said. "You're the second person I talked to today who worried about being spoofed. Spoofed means, like, a fraud or a deception, right?"
"Yes," she said.
She was a gawky woman with reddish-brown hair that barely escaped being mousy. She had brown eyes, looking at him through tortoiseshell glasses, and wore a dress that was conservatively fashionable. Lucas thought she might be 40.
"It's net slang. So what are we talking about here? You said you were investigating an automobile accident that has nothing to do with me, but that I might have some information about. I don't know about any automobile accident."
"Like I said, your information might be important, but it's peripheral to the accident."
"What accident?"
"An auto accident involving Senator Porter Smalls," Lucas said. "Was there something unusual about it? I thought that was all settled," she said. "He's a U.S. senator." "We're taking another routine look at it," Lucas said.
"Okay,"
she nodded. Lucas said, "Now, I understand you know a man named Jack Parrish," she said.
"Oh, boy,"
then stopped and put two fingers to her lips. "Lucas, what?"
"Oh, my God, did Parrish try to kill Porter Smalls?"
Lucas, astonished, smiled. "I see why you're a partner."
"Well, did he? I mean, Smalls's accident..."
She stopped again, gazing past him at the street, thinking. They were still standing in the doorway, and she suddenly said,
"Come in, come in. This is interesting."
Ingram's home was simply but expensively furnished. One living room wall held a single painting, but it looked a lot like a painting that Lucas had seen at the Minneapolis Institute of Art when weather made him go to a reception there. He bent to look at the signature, R.D. Ingram, standing behind him, said,
"Richard Diebenkorn. Do you know him?"
"I think I saw something by him at the Minneapolis Museum," Lucas said. "Looks nice."
"Well, yeah."
Her tone suggested that of course it looked nice because it was a fucking masterpiece.
"Part of the Ocean Park series."
"Cool." Lucas had never heard of the guy, but what else was he going to say? He turned and gazed at her for a few seconds and asked, "What's your opinion of Parrish?"
"He's a bad man," Ingram said. "You must have gotten my name through the Malone case."
"I don't know the Malone case," Lucas said.
"Then how'd you get my name?"
"I can't tell you. I got it from a confidential source who's involved with the government. If you say there's a Malone case, that could be where she got it."
"Hmph. She, huh? I'll think about that. Anyway, the Malone case involved one of my clients, Malone Materials. Malone lost a military procurement bid to another company and didn't understand why, since the other company had no expertise in the required area, which involved retrofitting certain military vehicles with lightweight side panel armor as protection against improvised explosive devices. We sued. There was never any absolute proof, but it became quite clear to me and others who were handling the case that Parrish had been involved in discussions between the Army procurement people and a number of members of both the House and the Senate. Their discussions ended with the other company, Intercorp Ballistics, getting higher procurement grades despite its lack of experience and markedly higher prices for the panels.
I believe money changed hands in a variety of ways, and some of it stuck to Parrish's hands and probably the hands of some members of the procurement team. A good bit probably wound up in re-election funds.
Bribes, Lucas said.
Not only bribes, but bribes that channeled money to a company with no experience in a mission-critical manufacturing operation and so risked the lives of American troops, Ingram said.
That's ugly, Lucas said.
Parrish seems to be doing quite well in his continuing military career in the Army Reserve. I didn't know that, but now that I do, I'll ask around. Do you really think that he tried to kill Smalls?
That's a conclusion you jumped to.
Don't bullshit me, Davenport. It won't work. I saw your face when I mentioned the Smalls accident.
She turned away, thinking, snapped her fingers, turned back, and said,
Got it. Smalls and Taryn Grant. Parrish now works for Grant. That is very, very interesting. Very.
Don't jump to more conclusions, and don't try to use that, Lucas said.
I don't think I'm jumping to anything, she said. You've got something about the accident, don't you? What is it? I'd love to get something good on Parrish and or Grant.
Lucas said, Ms. Ingram, let me suggest you forget about all these speculations. I'm afraid if you go somewhere with them, somebody might come to your nice brick house and hurt you.
Really?
Skepticism, not a question. Really, Lucas said. Listen, we're looking at a bare possibility. The most likely thing that happened in the Smalls accident is that he and the driver both had a little to drink. She lost it and went off the road. We need to check, and that's what I'm doing. I've gotten the impression from other people that Parrish is a dangerous guy. If you try to stick it to him, or he thinks you will, you could have a problem.
I will take that under advisement, she said.
Sit tight for a couple of weeks. That's all you have to do, Lucas said. By that time, I'll have figured out whether Parrish was involved in the accident. If he was, I'll handle it. If he wasn't, I'll let you know. No point in taking risks that you don't have to.
I will take that under advisement as well, she said.
Boy, Taryn Grant and Jack Parrish. That's a mix and match, huh?
They actually, Lucas cut himself off,
are well suited to each other. That's what you were about to say, Ingram said.
I don't know much about Grant, but I do know about the controversy when she was elected.
Were you involved in that investigation?
I led it for the state, Lucas said.
Now you're a federal marshal.
There wasn't any political influence involved in that, was there?
Lucas shook his head. I didn't know you were a trial attorney.
So, I'm starting to see it. U.S. Senator gets jobbed by an opposition candidate who takes his seat. He gets himself elected again and immediately begins peeing on his opponent's shoes, or, in Grant's case, her Christian Louboutin pumps. Grant is a murderous witch who lands on the Senate Intelligence Committee, where she connects with a hustler who has ties both to the military and the CIA, and does her a favor by trying to kill the U.S. senator who's peeing on her presidential chances. Smalls, who has used his influence to get the man who saved his bacon an appointment as a federal marshal, gets the marshal to investigate the witch, Ingram said, finally taking a breath.
Man! Is this a great country or what?
Lucas said he'd stay in touch, and Ingram said, Oh, do! I'm fascinated.
Back in his car, he tried to call the other two people on the list and again got no answer, so he headed back to the hotel.
After leaving his car with the valet, he was walking through the lobby when the security chief, who he had met when he was checking in, flagged him over. He'd learned the man's name was Steve Schneider.
Did you have a friend in your room?
A male friend, maybe another marshal? Schneider asked.
A friend?
No, what happened? One of my guys was doing routine floor checks, and he heard a door close. A guy was coming down the hall, and my guy got the impression he'd come out of that stub hallway to your room. There was no reason to stop him, so he went on his way. There's nobody in the other room on that hall. I thought I should mention it.
Thanks. Any sign he'd actually been inside my room?
No, no. We would have stopped him if we thought he had been, Schneider said.
Can I talk to your guy?
Sure. I think he's down in the parking structure if you want to wait in the bar.
Lucas got a Diet Coke, and Schneider and his guy showed up 5 minutes later. The second security man was named Jeff Toombs, white-haired with a ruddy face in a gray suit. An ex-cop, Lucas thought.
There wasn't any reason to stop him at first, Toombs told Lucas. What happened was I was doing my checks, and I came out of the stairwell and started toward the hallway that goes to the rooms. I heard a door close as I turned the corner, and there was a guy walking toward me. I'd say 6 feet, maybe a half inch either way. Close-cut brown hair, brown eyes. Looked to be in very good shape. Clean-shaven, decent pale blue summer suit, polished lace-up shoes. If he was carrying a gun, it would have been in the small of his back. No gun sag on the sides, and the suit wasn't cut for a shoulder rig. I suppose he could have had an ankle wrap, but who has those?
And he was by my room, Lucas said.
That's what I realized as I was walking by. I think he had to come out of your hallway. There's only 2 rooms down there, and when I checked later, I found out there's nobody checked into the other one.
Lucas said, you heard the door actually close.
Yes, another thing. You're on 4, and I realized that I didn't hear the elevator bell, the one that rings when the doors open. I went back. I was going to see what room he was in or who he was visiting, but he was gone. He had to have taken the stairs. That'd be unusual unless you were in a hurry. I called Steve, but nobody saw him again. He would have gotten lost in the lobby.
He'd have been in a hurry because he'd been surprised by a guy he recognized as security.
The thought crossed our minds, Schneider said.
Lucas said, well, hell.
Schneider came up to the room with him. Lucas popped the door, and they both eased inside. Lucas looked at his luggage and briefcase, but nothing seemed out of place, missing or added. Schneider tipped his head toward the door, and Lucas followed him into the hall.
"I know a guy who could sweep it for you," Schneider said.
"Or better, I could move you across the hall but leave you registered in this room."
"Let's do that," Lucas said.
"Then if somebody else shows up, I'll actually be behind them. I might even hear them going in."
"If you shoot somebody, try not to hit any guests," Schneider said. Unless it's an old lady with a mink hat carrying a rat.
A rat?
Okay, a chihuahua. That'd be Mrs. Julia Benson, grass widow. She lives here, $18,000 a month, and she doesn't care. She likes servants. I'm apparently one of them. Biggest pain in the ass in the building. I wouldn't want you to kill her, but wounding her a little would get you some free drinks.
I'll keep that in mind. Lucas said.
7. Lucas settled into his new room across the hall from his previous one and without the view of the Potomac. He struggled briefly with a spasm of paranoia. Did guys in nice suits break into hotel rooms occupied by U.S. Marshals? In Washington, D.C., in a place called Watergate? Really? When that moment had passed, he called Smalls, who blurted, "Can't talk at this exact minute. Call me back in 4 minutes." Lucas called back in 4 minutes and asked, "You were with somebody inconvenient?" Smalls said,
"No, I was standing at a urinal. I'm at a luncheon. Try not to call when I'm taking a leak."
"All right."
He told Smalls about the possible illegal entry and asked, "Have you told people that I'm looking at the accident?"
"I had to tell a couple of people at the office. I trust them, and I told them not to talk to anyone else. I took my wife to lunch, and I didn't even tell her."
"There's a leak somewhere, Senator, and it's probably Grant."
"You might think about that," Lucas said.
"Now I'll be working out in the open, I guess. If this was an entry and not a mistake by the security guy, if it's not a mistake, I mean, they knew where my room was."
"I think a mistake's most likely, though given the shot they took at me, the attack, you can't know for sure, can you?"
Lucas carried a Sony voice-activated recorder in his pack, a unit only 5 inches long and less than an inch and a half wide. He dug it out, checked the battery, found a place to leave it, tucked under the mattress at the head of the bed, with only the microphone sticking out. He recorded precisely 10 seconds of sound from the room television, a CNN news report. If somebody found the recorder and erased it, or simply took it, he would know as much as he would if it recorded somebody coming and going. He called the last two names on Carter's list, still got no answer. Since both numbers were supposedly good, and both supposedly to cell phones, he suspected that the calls were being ignored. He had decided to drive back across the river, find the houses, hang around until someone showed, when a call came into his cell phone from an unknown number. He said, "Lucas Davenport."
"Marshal Davenport, this is Carl Armstrong, the accident investigator."
"Hey, Carl, what's up, man?"
"You mentioned that lawnmower lady saw a black Ford F-250 going through town. There's a nursery there with a video camera that covers the street. I asked them to let me take a look, and I spotted the truck and got the tags. It's out of Virginia, but there's a problem."
"Like what?"
"The truck I saw on the video was black, like the lawnmower lady said, but when I looked up the registration, it says the truck is blue."
"So what do you think?" Lucas asked.
"If I was gonna do something like run another car off the road and I thought somebody might see me or remember me, I'd steal the plates off another 250 and change them."
"I would too," Lucas said. "Give me the details. I'll look into it. What about faces? Could you see the guys in the truck?"
"You can see them, but you can't quite make them out. I could see sunglasses and black hats."
"Could you send me the video?"
"Sure, I got it here. I'll email it to you. I had our computer guy make it the highest resolution he could."
"This is good stuff, Carl." The video came in, but it wasn't much to look at. The black pickup rolled past the camera, but the two people in the cab were obscured by reflections off its windows. Lucas agreed with Armstrong that the men were wearing sunglasses, but he wasn't sure about the hats. To Lucas, it looked more like one of the men had long, dark hair. The truck was registered from a place called Centerville, which Lucas found on a Google map. A D.C. suburb, it was straight west across the river in Virginia. He turned on the tape recorder, tucked it into the mattress, put the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob, and went down to get his car. The afternoon was getting on, but Lucas was in front of the first wave of the outgoing rush hour and made it into Centerville in a half hour, following the Evoque's GPS. The license tag had gone to a Gerald and Marie Blake who lived in a townhouse complex off I-66. The complex didn't have a parking lot as such, but instead, nose-in parking right off the street. Lucas cruised the Blake's address. The truck was parked out front, blue Ford F-250, but the plates no longer showed the number that Armstrong had given him. There was no sign that the truck had ever been involved in an accident. Lucas considered for a bit, then pulled in, popped the restraining strap on his pistol, walked up to the front door, and pushed the doorbell. A minute later, the door opened and a teenage girl looked out at him.
Lucas, are your parents home?
Girl, who wants to know?
Lucas took out his ID case with the badge. U.S. Marshal Lucas Davenport, I need to talk to Gerald or Marie Blake or both of them.
Girl, turning. Mom!
Marie Blake came to the door a minute later, peering at him nearsightedly through computer glasses. She took them off as the girl said,
He says he's a U.S. Marshal. He has a badge.
What's going on? The woman asked.
Lucas explained what he was doing, and she said,
We've never been to West Virginia, even passing through. We moved here from Delaware.
Her husband, she said, was at work. He was a bureaucrat with the Bureau of Land Management.
Lucas asked, Do you know what your license plate number is?
No. There's an insurance card in the cab. That should have the license number on it.
Lucas knew what would happen, but they went out and looked anyway. The number on the truck didn't match the number on the insurance card because the tags had been stolen off the Blake's truck and replaced. He got back on the phone to Armstrong.
Do you have access to a database of stolen license plates in Virginia?
Sure. Take me a minute.
Lucas gave him the tag number, and a minute later Armstrong came back and said,
Those plates were taken off a blue F-250, probably at the Fair Oaks Mall a week ago.
They weren't replaced with anything else. They were simply gone. The owner saw they were missing as soon as he came out of the mall, so he called the cops and reported it.
The day before the accident, Lucas said.
Yes.
They didn't want the Blakes to notice that their tags were gone, so they replaced them with another stolen set. That way, it'd take two steps to catch them. A cop would have to stop the Blakes and report the Blakes' tags as missing, then spot the bad guy's truck, which nobody did.
Looks like it, Armstrong said.
They were stuck. Lucas rang off, told Blake she had a problem with the license plates, that hers had been stolen and probably dumped somewhere after a crime had been committed. She needed to get new ones. He gave her a card and told her that if anyone at the Virginia DMV gave her a hard time, to have them call him. He still had two more people to talk to from Carter's list. Since he wasn't far from where they lived, he decided to drop in. At his first stop, he saw somebody working inside James T. Knapp's house, so he leaned on the doorbell until a heavy-set woman came to the door.
What?
Lucas identified himself and said, I'm looking for Mr. Knapp.
I'm the housekeeper. What did he do?
Nothing, as far as I know. I'm checking up on somebody Mr. Knapp knows.
Huh.
The woman scowled at him as though judging his genuineness and finally admitted,
He's gone off to California on some sort of mission.
He's in the military?
No, he's a preacher. He's gone off on a preacher mission. Supposed to be back next week, but he paid me in advance for the week after that, too.
At the next house, a standalone ranch style painted blue and gray in a quiet neighborhood of similar houses and trees and small lawns, he was walking away from the front door when a black 5-liter Mustang pulled into the driveway. A thin, rangy, heavily tanned man in a blue army uniform got out. He had Lieutenant Colonel Silver Leaves on his shoulders.
Hello? He called out.
Lucas walked over and identified himself, and the colonel said,
Horace Stout, what can I do for you?
I need to talk to you about Jack Parrish. Stout grimaced and said,
Better come inside.
Stout was single but kept a neat place that included a studio grand piano, a Model M Steinway in a corner of the living room with a pile of piano music on its closed lid. Lucas said that his wife had a similar model, and Stout said,
That's what I got out of 11 years of marriage.
bat and a sick dog which died last year.
Sorry about that, Lucas muttered.
Can I get you an orange juice or a vitamin water? Stout asked. I don't keep any alcohol.
Juice would be fine, Lucas said.
They sat at Stout's kitchen table, and Lucas assured him that anything he said about Parrish would be kept confidential.
I'm not taking testimony. I'm trying to get a grip on the guy. Who he is, what he's like, what he does.
Right now, he works for Senator Taron Grant, Stout said. But you know that.
I do.
My experience with him was in Iraq. Our tours overlapped. He did 2, I did 5, working basically with logistics out of Kuwait into Baghdad.
He has a purple heart and a bronze star, Lucas said. I assumed he had a combat role.
Stout sighed and finally said, You know, Marshal Davenport, it's not right to speak poorly of an absent officer.
It could be important, Lucas said. I assume you could speak poorly if you wished.
After a short silence, Stout looked away and said, Some people get medals. Guys get minor but real wounds, and a local medic bandages them and gives them a couple of pills, and they never see a Purple Heart. Other guys get what you might call owies, and they get the Purple Heart. Same with Bronze Stars. Nobody in the military will talk about it, but there's sometimes a political component to the award.
You're saying that Parrish...
I'm not saying anything specific, Stout said. I'm saying it happens with some people.
Lucas said, The reason I'm talking to you is I heard you didn't care for Parrish. When we're doing investigations, we try to talk with people who...
I know what you're doing, Stout said.
I don't care for Parrish. Not at all. You know, when you're working in logistics in a war zone, stuff has to be done in a hurry, and sometimes material goes astray.
Parrish stole stuff?
Stout ticked a finger at him.
I'm not saying he stole stuff. I'm just saying an inordinate amount of material went astray after it passed through his unit. He had an E-8 working for him.
I'm sorry, I don't know military ranks.
E-8, Master Sergeant. It's no big secret that the Army has some crooked NCOs, but I believe that man was one of the crookedest I've ever encountered. He retired to a rather lush lifestyle down on the Gulf Coast, as I hear it. But even that...
He paused, thinking it over, and Lucas pressed him.
What?
Nobody else is listening.
There were a lot of private military contractors roaming around Iraq. Our security guards were contracted out of Africa, for instance. Uganda, mostly, although they usually worked for stateside-based companies, Stout said. I'll tell you, Marshal. Parrish was way too close to these guys, the stateside managers. Most straight-up officers stayed well away from those assholes. Not Jack. Jack seemed to think they were romantic warriors. He liked hanging with them. I suspect, but I can't prove, that some of the missing material went out to these guys.
Lucas said, That's interesting. Is he still close with them, these companies?
That's the word. He went to the CIA after he left the Army, and the CIA uses a lot of the same contractor organizations. After the CIA, Parrish worked for one of them for a while. I don't like him, and he doesn't like me. Thinks I'm a prig.
He glanced at Lucas as if trying to figure out whether Lucas knew what a prig was, then continued.
What I don't like is he wasn't... A professional officer. He's a hustler. He was a hustler in the Army, a hustler in the CIA. People are talking about Senator Grant running for the presidency, so now he's hustling that.
That word gets used a lot when people are talking about Parrish, Lucas said. When he was with the Senate Intelligence Committee, there was a stink about the bombing of a marketplace in Syria.
I know about that, Stout said. If the place is full of poison gas, he's a hero. If it turns out there's nothing but a bunch of dead towel heads, who cares? A typical Parrish operation, in my opinion.
Was there any particular military contractor he was especially tight with? Stout nodded.
There's the one I mentioned where he worked for a while, Heracles Personnel, he said. Don't tell anyone that I told you that. They're big in the military contractor world. They've got a private army, along with the usual support staff.
They talked for a bit longer, and when Lucas said goodbye, Stout shook his hand and said,
Listen, Marshal, give me a call when you're done with this. I'd like to know what happened.
If I can, Lucas said. He was on his way back to the hotel when Armstrong called again from West Virginia.
I don't mean to bother you, Armstrong said.
You're not bothering me, Carl, Lucas said. What's up?
I've been thinking. That F-250 is a common truck, but more out in the rural areas than in urban places. Whoever switched those plates found the two trucks close to each other, which maybe means they scouted them out in advance, which might mean that they actually live or work in that general area.
Yeah, possibly.
So I got to wondering, how many F-250s are there in that zip code?
The Virginia DMV can sort vehicles by zip code, I checked, Armstrong said.
If you could get a list and compare that list with driver's license photos and then run those guys through the Internet, you might come up with something.
Not that I'm saying there's anything to come up with.
Carl, you're a smart guy.
Lucas had several things working. Somebody may have tried to break into his hotel suite and may actually have succeeded. He had a name. Heracles Personnel. And now he had an idea of how to find the F-250. His nominal boss worked out of the Marshals Service headquarters no more than a few miles from where he was, but telephones were faster. As he drove back toward Washington against rush hour traffic, he got hold of Russell Fort, who was about to leave for home. Lucas asked him to get whatever information he could on Heracles Personnel and to see if the Virginia DMV could produce a list of black F-250s around the area where the plates had been stolen and driver's license photos of the registered owners.
Well, hell, I didn't want to go home and talk to my wife and kids and go to all the trouble of cranking up the barbecue and cooking up those ribs my wife bought this afternoon.
Go home, Russell. Lucas said, tomorrow's fine. I've got a couple of places I want to visit in Washington anyway. I'll check with you in the morning. Not too early.
Thank you, Fort said.
When Lucas got back to the hotel, he ate dinner, went to his room, took a quick shower, then dressed carefully in a medium blue summer weight suit with a checked dress shirt, a slender Hermes necktie, and black John Lobb shoes. He thought about taking the Walther, but the gun messed with the drape of his jacket. He finally locked it in the room safe, although he happened to know how to open any hotel room safe in approximately 8 seconds. When he was ready, he called down to the front desk to get a cab, and 10 minutes later was on his way up New Hampshire Avenue to Figueroa and Prince, a men's tailor shop that he'd read about, done research on, and finally called before he left St. Paul. The shop was on N Street, on the bottom floor of what looked like a New York brownstone, even though it was constructed of red brick, a three-story building with only a small silver sign next to the door designating it as a commercial establishment. When Lucas tried the door, it was locked, although he'd been told they were open until 9 o'clock.
He took a step back, spotted another small sign, this one saying, "Please ring for entry." He pushed the doorbell button. An apple-cheeked young man looked out the window at him, and a buzzer sounded to let Lucas in. The young man did a quick eye check on Lucas's